Lettman v. Commonwealth, Andrew J. Cornett, Appellant Counsel, Matthew P. Milligan, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Affiliated Counsel.
You may proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Andy Cornick here on behalf of Mark Savetnik, who's appealing his conviction in the Stafford Circuit Court of assault and battery against Sharon Beck. The issue before the Court is whether the trial court improperly or impermissibly limited cross-examination as to financial motive to fabricate and as to her prior inconsistent statements made about the crime that was at issue. The court, pretty early on in cross-examination, asked what was the basis of this bankruptcy filing, what was I getting into, and I said this lady has a financial motivation to lie. She's using the appellant's wife as a source of income. She sees his reconciliation essentially as a threat to her financial livelihood. The court said, I will allow you to develop that. I won't let you document it. That would be collateral. Through the course of the cross-examination, it then became apparent that she stated under oath that she did not remember what she said to the deputy as he was investigating the crime. With regard to this prior injury to her nose, the court at that point did not allow Mr. Savetnik to develop the prior inconsistent statement through the playing of the statement to Deputy Zotos. Basically what we're saying is that was an error, an abuse of discretion, and that in fact was something touching on cross-examination of constitutional right, which this court should in fact review for harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt.
Exactly what were you forbidden? Were you counsel?
I was.
Okay, what were you forbidden to inquire about? I know that the broken nose part. Other than that, what?
I was forbidden from introducing and then arguing about the bankruptcy filing, the petition for bankruptcy that she had recently made prior to trial. The Court of Appeals erred, and I think the Stafford Circuit Court erred in saying that is collateral. The Court of Appeals specifically focused its reasoning for denying me that on it being whether or not she's lying about this crime, and saying I apologize, I'm misconstruing that. That's the Attorney General's argument. He said, you know, when he's actually trying to introduce this thing, it's about whether or not she's lying about this crime. I think that it was misinterpreted to say that the only thing I was saying there was she's lying about having had her nose broken before. That goes back to the initial proffer, why I'm getting into all this stuff pretty early on in the cross-examination of her having a financial basis to lie. So that's what we were forbidden from doing. That's what we were forbidden from developing fully on cross-examination. That being said,
did you ever move in, what was it, the bankruptcy petition you had?
Yes.
And you moved it in to show that she had a financial motivation to lie, or you moved it in to show that she had once seen the same ENT doctor who treated her broken nose after this incident?
At trial, I attempted to move it in to show that she had seen this ENT doctor beforehand. Subsequent to the hearing of the evidence, I proffered regarding the earlier denial of my ability to get that in, that it had a... Well, I proffered after the fact. I was doing that because the court did not allow me to do so early on in the cross-examination. I think it's in the 60s of the joint appendix. With respect to appellate review, I would hope this court would look at it for both reasons.
But your proffer was that would go to the credibility of the witness. I mean, on page 232, when you're making your proffer, defense would also have elicited the evidence of the body mic, et cetera, and you end by saying that would have gone to the credibility of the witness. So you're offering, it appears that you're offering the bankruptcy petition to challenge her credibility. That's your proffer to the court.
Yes. Yes, I was attempting to do that earlier. The credibility being, and the argument being that if she has a financial reason to be dependent on Mr. Svetnik's wife, that she is not a credible witness when she testifies that he did something that will keep them, that they believe will keep them from his family.
You don't see those two statements, that she has a financial reliance on the wife going to her bias, and she lied about having a broken nose, going to her credibility, as being two separate things?
Those would be two separate things. I agree with that. And I think on the proffer, either one, if she's saying it affecting her credibility, if she's lying about having seen the doctor before, or if she has a financial motivation to lie.
But every question you ask her about financial reliance on the wife, she answered. What credibility issue was there? She answered every question. Did you know about the lawsuits? Did you borrow $300? Did you use her credit card? Yes, 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 and yes. What credibility issue are you challenging there?
I think a fair inference for a juror is that with a recent bankruptcy filing, there is a strain, essentially, and with the evidence we were able to adduce that Mrs. Svetnik contributed to her financial well-being, that would be an additional amount of evidence cutting against her on the issue of credibility.
And if that had been the proffer you had made, I would agree with you, but the proffer to the court was, I'm introducing this for her credibility. I'm just not sure how the trial court sitting there would know that you were attempting to issue or to get that bankruptcy petition in with regard to, I mean, it would have made logical sense, but I just don't see how the trial court would glean that from what you said.
I think if I could...
Perhaps I'm not looking at...
For just a second, I want to say so 68 of the joint appendix. Actually, 66, I apologize. We can demonstrate through evidence that I have the proper, if it's admissible. It's a reason to lie about whether or not Mr. Svetnik is the person of the incident. So at the time I'm attempting to introduce it later in trial, I think it's fair to concede that I'm attempting to get it in by any means necessary. But the proffer after the hearing of the evidence is, again, what I'm asking this court to consider when the court initially said, I'll allow you to cross-examine it, but I won't allow you to document it.
Well, but after the court told you that, did you try to move in the bankruptcy petition when you were talking to her about her financial dependence on the wife?
I did not. That was in response to the trial court's instruction not to attempt to document it. And I believe I asked the court to note my exception prior to that.
Did the jury know that she had filed bankruptcy recently?
I do not believe so.
So you got everything in except the documentation of that which you got in?
Yes, and the prior inconsistent statement made
about the note.
I'm sorry?
About the note.
Yes,
sir.
Right.
The rules on a prior inconsistent statement had to do with things that are material and not collateral. You know that?
Yes, I agree.
Well, in the Allen case, we said the fact is wholly collateral to the main issue, that the fact cannot be used in evidence for any purpose other than for contradiction. In other words, if you couldn't have put it in the evidence in your case in chief, you're not going to be able to use it for a prior inconsistent statement for impeachment. How does yours fit?
In this case, I don't concede that the statement is collateral. This is the complaining witness speaking to the investigator.
I just read you what the rule is.
Yes.
All right? So if that's the rule, why isn't it collateral?
It's not collateral because it's a statement about the incident, but it's a statement in response.
Not about the incident, it's about a prior incident.
It is, and if I could take one moment, I apologize.
That's all right.
Our argument is that if it is a statement given by the complaining witness that, again, at this point, was a malicious wounding case about whether or not an injury had occurred prior, that, I suppose, and I have not briefed this, could be relevant to the issue of intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill, or malice. In other words, some of the things that the trial court touched on during the motion to strike about whether or not certain behavior can be used to demonstrate those two elements of the crime as it existed at the time, I think a statement about that is certainly relevant when it's discussing the events of the, or characterizing the events of the evening between the complaining witness and the investigating officer.
So in other words, what you're saying now is, well, if the defendant knew that, that the nose had been broken before, maybe there was an intent to break it again. And therefore, that would be material to malice.
No, I think that, some of the prior case law allows a court to consider the nature of the injury as it as evidence of the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill.
I didn't see that as your argument. And I'm reading from your brief.
Yes.
You say this isn't collateral because, quote, if defense had been allowed to prove by previous recordings that Beck had lied either under oath or to a police officer during the investigation of the Betnicks, she could be shown to be lying now. In other words, I read that as, this isn't collateral because it's really good. I need this evidence because it shows that she's lying, and if it shows that she's lying, therefore it's not collateral. Do you see there's a certain circularity about that?
As you characterized it, I would agree there's circularity about that, but I think, again, in a case where, such as this, you have two people who are eyewitnesses to the offense, their credibility is so key to the disposition of the jury trial that when at the very time she's
so it's not, again, it's not collateral because it's too good not to be collateral.
Because it's the product of the conversation that caused these charges to be brought in the first place. And I agree it's good. I wish the court had let me use it. If I could reserve the rest of my time for it.
Thank you.
Please, the court. My name is Matthew Dolgan, Senior Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Commonwealth in the case this morning. As we've outlined in the brief, there are two, counting the harmless error analysis, the Court of Appeals introduced three separate reasons this appeal should be dismissed. The threshold, the assignment of error granted in this case, was whether the trial court had improper limited cross-examination. As we've cited to in our brief, each objection to his cross-examination was in fact overruled. He was allowed to ask all the questions he wished, particularly all the questions he wished on the issues that he's discussed in his brief, the alleged financial dependence of the victim on the then estranged wife and her recollection of prior statements. His argument is not with the scope of cross-examination was allowed. His argument is with respect to these document and an audio recording that were not allowed in. Both are completely collateral. He's argued this morning and made allusion to in his brief without, I don't believe, a citation that I found, that he'd offered the bankruptcy filing to show her general financial situation. But as we cited in the brief, at the point he offered it in the trial, I'm looking at Joint Appendix 85, the court asked directly, what relevance does that have to this proceeding? The answer was whether she's lying under oath about this crime. There was no argument made at that point that had anything to do other than the fact that she had been to see an ENT doctor at a prior occasion. Similarly, with respect to the conversation...
Where is the bankruptcy filing referenced in his brief? Maybe I should ask him that question. But
in his brief, I have not tabbed his brief. I can look.
Okay. Well, he can answer the question. Thank you.
Similarly, with the statement of Deputy Zotto, while the recording was not allowed in, he was allowed to develop with the witness whether she had a conversation with Deputy Zotto. She did not recall making a statement, but nevertheless went on to explain that it was a stressful moment and her recollection and conversation with Deputy Zotto was not the best. She never denied having made the purported statement to Deputy Zotto about whether or not her nose had been broken. Most importantly, though, she never said anything in the case in chief about whether or not her nose had not been broken, most simply because it's not relevant to the charges that were being prosecuted at the time. it would have been objectionable had the Commonwealth inquired about any prior injuries he had. She made statement apparently at the preliminary hearing having to do with the prior history, but the jury, prior to the issue being brought out in cross, had never heard anything about any prior injuries. There was no prior state testimony to the jury, which is the point of the prior inconsistent statement rule. No evidence that would be impeached by a prior inconsistent statement, would there have been no testimony on the point in the first place. Again, because it's not relevant to any issue that was before the jury in this trial. Mr. Betnich had the opportunity to cross her at length about both the financial relationships, about his theory that she was financially dependent and had a motive to continue the estrangement rather than allow reconciliation and therefore to bring these charges. And despite it being irrelevant, had an opportunity to go into the reason she might have said something different to Deputy Zotto than she said in the early part of cross-examination. But not only are the rulings by the trial court perfectly proper exercise of discretion to exclude wholly collateral matters, the cross-examination he was allowed to get into covered the exact themes that he wanted, he says, to be able to present and argue to the jury. And so the Court of Appeals is also correct to hold that if there was any abuse of discretion in any of the trial court's rulings, it was certainly harmless error under the applicable statute, because the substance of all the areas he wanted to cover by these excluded documents was in fact covered. For all three reasons then, both of the issues he has briefed and argued are outside the scope of the assignment of error, because the trial court properly exercises discretion to exclude wholly collateral document and recording evidence, and because the gist of the matters he seeks to cover by the excluded evidence were covered in his cross-examination of this witness, and it's any error is harmless. For all three reasons, we argue that this appeal should be dismissed.
Thank you very much. You have 3 minutes, 42 seconds for rebuttal.
With regard to your question, it's admittedly not explicit, but page 8, the paragraph regarding the instant case, counsel sought to show the financial bias of Beck because she relied on Patricia as a source.
Right, but you never, I mean, you do talk about financial bias, and that's obviously including the assignment of error, but the bankruptcy filings never mentioned at all.
And not explicitly. I would point in the argument that's where I was. If the Attorney General concedes that,
I mean, the reason I ask that is I'm just having trouble figuring out what the error is.
I think the error on both counts is cutting off the. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Okay. The error on both counts with the bankruptcy filing and on the prior inconsistent statement, I think the Attorney General has conceded it to some extent, as there was cross-examination on it, but I was stopped at a point when I contend the rules of evidence allow me to continue. That, to me, is the abuse of discretion, and that's the evidence that this court can rely on to say that the Stafford Circuit Court impermissibly limited that. Very briefly on whether or not that error was harmless, whether I'm right...
Let me ask you a question here about the bankruptcy filing as it affects the financial motivation to lie. When would you have attempted to introduce it? Because the victim in this case admitted all of your questions. Didn't you use her credit card? Yes. Didn't you borrow $300 from her? Yes. Don't you know about all of her lawsuits? Yes. I helped her put together her information for her lawsuits. So there, when would you even have the opportunity to introduce the bankruptcy filing at that point? Did you ask her? Didn't you file for bankruptcy?
I don't believe I asked her that question.
Okay. So I don't know how it even would come up in for that. I'm just putting aside whether she ever broke her nose before, because mm-hmm. she listed the doctor on her filing. How would the bankruptcy filing even come up during the bias section of your cross-examination?
I think that the argument at this point has to be that I was curtailed prior to the attempt to introduce it. If you don't agree with me there and we're just down to the prior inconsistent statement, again, this is a situation where you have two eyewitnesses, you have physical evidence that both corroborates and refutes the allegation. You have Mr. Savetnik's clean hands moments afterwards observed. You have a woman who's clearly been injured according to the medical testimony. That medical testimony did not exclude a reasonable theory of innocence. So with that in mind, when you have two people and credibility is, with two people disputing how this occurred, the credibility is key, and I would ask you to find that even if the bankruptcy petition is not properly before this court, that the failure to allow me to play the recording of a prior consistent statement was not harmless error.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. Call the next case.
Rodalco, Trustee Etcetera versus Georgiadis and others, David E. Hopper, Appellant Counsel, QT Antrim, John T. O'Hara, and Michael G. Matheson, Appellate Counsel.